Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of IGN Unfiltered, the monthly interview series where I get to sit down with the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the video game industry. And I'm joined by Mitch Gittleman, a man you maybe not a household name.
Not until now. This is the moment where I break out.
Xbox fans probably know this man if you go way back. And then currently you are beloved for resurrecting awesome IPs that had been dormant for so long.
Shadowrun has
returned under your watch, and now Battletech returning as well. We'll get to those. We're gonna take a walk back in time with me, Mitch.
I'm afraid, but okay, let's do this.
It's all right. Yeah. So I want to start. So you've had a long career in
games. Yeah, you grab great people and you bring them in and sit in the chair. Is that the deal?
Yeah, Peter Molyneux was here. Yeah. All kinds.
He's
of
great. Well, he used to be great. Now he's just bald. But yeah, hey Peter, what's up?
What made you want to get into the industry?
Wow. I remember. It was a long time ago. I wanted to get into the industry because I was a huge role-playing game nerd.
Tabletop?
Right? Tabletop. Oh, yeah. D&D.
Yeah.
Like, I found D&D in 1978, and it was the blue book, the basic set.
Sure.
And I was just taken with that. That was it. And I really thought, even though I was in retail, and eventually I moved into retail, I've had careers before this, I always wanted to write role-playing games. That was like the thing.
Yeah.
And then one day, one of my friends who was running a role-playing company, and I was writing for him freelance on the side, said, we should just do video games. They need people like us. They're like, yeah, they need people that don't know how to use a computer. Absolutely. And I jumped into video games.
Is that guy's name Jordan Wiseman?
It is not.
We'll get to him, too.
Oh, that guy.
So what were you doing before you got into games?
So I was in retail management, but then I became a management trainer. And I would travel around the country doing classes in how to manage humans.
Yeah. Did you enjoy that?
I loved it.
Yeah?
Oh, I absolutely loved it. I didn't like the travel. Yeah, I had a young daughter at the time, so I didn't like being away from my wife and daughter at the time. But yeah, actually, I found that people management was actually my calling.
Huh.
Right? And I'm serious.
Yeah.
Like when, I don't remember how old I was, 28, I think. I was younger than that. I was 22.
Oh, wow.
I was 22, and suddenly it occurred to me, like, people management was a noble thing. For, like, treating people like human beings was a big deal. And I started reading books about it and stuff, and I sort of self-trained on that, and it became like, no joke, like a calling. It was like, that's what I do with my life. And I just happen to make video games while managing people.
So if that's your calling,
yeah,
why leave it?
That company, I reached the top of where I wanted to be in that company. They wanted me to move to Dallas to be in the corporate office, and I'm not going to move to Dallas. It seems like a really nice place, but I was a Chicago boy, and
yeah,
it's like I thought I'd stay in Chicago my whole life.
So, walk me through how you end up at Microsoft, because that's, you're talking about sort of ascending to the top of the mountain. You know, Microsoft is one of the peaks in the mountain range of the games industry as well.
Dumb luck, really. I mean, I started freelancing for Sony, made a PlayStation 1 first wave title that only came out in Europe.
Huh.
And then,
what was it?
It was called Sentient,
and
that was a game with big aspirations because I had no idea how to make video games. So it was a kitchen sink game design,
right?
Me and a partner, and every single thing you could think of was a feature in the game, at least on paper.
Yeah.
Anyway, it got 5 stars from Edge magazine, and then they ported it to PC in America, and it got like 2 stars. It just didn't work out. Whatever. And then after that, I was making children's games. I made a Where's Waldo game.
Oh, cool.
Like that. It was cool. And Sillywood games. That, you know, I forgot about that. See, look at what you're bringing back. You know, yeah. You remember Sillywood?
I don't, actually.
So this
I remember like the putt-putt stuff that Ron Gilbert was doing.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I made that. But no, I'm talking about after the children's games, I was making live-action video games with live actors.
Oh, I remember that era.
That's what Sillywood. That's okay. What we called it. Sillywood. Not Hollywood. It's Sillywood.
I see
and,
now.
You know,
I'm
DVDs
with you.
Were invented. It's like, oh my god.
Yeah.
You know, you can push all this stuff on.
Seventh Guest and Sewer Shark.
That's
and that
exactly
kind of stuff.
Right. That's the stuff I'm talking about. And I made one called Eraser Turnabout. It was the game. It was the movie Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
But we didn't have the rights to his likeness or his voice, and we couldn't. So it's like make a video game based on this movie.
A live action thing.
Yeah, yeah. But without him and without alluding to him at all.
Okay.
You know, without even using his character name in it. And,
yeah.
You know, make one with a lot of live action and puzzles and stuff.
Huh.
But that was fun to make.
So I'm seeing now, like, yeah, you're claiming to you didn't know how to make games. But
nope.
I guess if you're just writing, it's writing live action things. It's like you took a natural
too.
Transition.
I was designing the puzzles and the
yeah.
games and stuff like that, and all of these things, and just going on instinct. And you can do that. At the you got to understand, I'm a product of a time, right? Once upon a time, anybody could make. Well, I guess we're back to that now. In
yeah,
a way,
any development.
With the egalitarian of the tools,
sure.
which is kind of cool. But at the time, you had to find somebody to sort of. Believe you could do it, and I was just a bullshit artist. The industry, well, eventually, yeah, you start somewhere, but yeah, I've faked it for years. Just, well, made it up. That's the best way to put it. I just ran on instinct and made it up.
And found your way to Microsoft.
Yeah, so eventually, after the Sillywood era, Jordan Weissman, who's the creator of Battletech and Shadowrun and WizKids and Crimson Skies and... Jeez, I don't know. I think he just sort of invented everything, you know. He's kind of like Willy Wonka.
He's got a lot of cool IPs under his belt.
Oh, yeah. The guy's the most creative person I know. He really is. So we had been flirting around working together for years. He had the Battletech pods. Do you remember those things? It's a cockpit, and you actually got into it. His dream always from making Battletech, he made the board game, but what he really wanted to do was to make these pods where you get into it.
That's why I'm like, I'm sighing because it's like the term is coming back to me, but I can't see it.
Yeah. Battletech Centers, look it up. They're awesome.
Okay.
So 16 cockpits networked together, right? Like in 1990,
yeah.
Something like that. So it was like the first 3D multiplayer game. You know, it was like a LAN game.
Hell yeah.
No,
that's
it
awesome.
Was a LAN game. And you get in the cockpit and every single button worked, and there's 2 foot pedals, 2 joysticks, throttle, you know, it was awesome. 2 view screens, and you could talk to each other on microphone. Anyway.
That's cool.
So, yeah. So we were going to work together on that, and then he wanted to make a flight game for the cockpits, and he hired me to produce and design Crimson Skies, what became
the original
Crimson
for PC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was originally supposed to be location-based entertainment. It was supposed to be another use for these cockpits. But then, yeah. And what happened was we started designing it together and creating the world together. And then we shelved that temporarily. And then I went on to Mech Commander. And after shipping Mech Commander... Oh, and while I was shipping Mech Commander, he was making a board game version of Crimson Skies. Because once he's got a taste of something,
yeah.
He just has to make it.
All down the rabbit
yeah,
hole?
Yeah, he has to. It's like, oh, it's not a video game? Fine, it's a board game. Fine, it's a comic book. Whatever. He's just got to make it. Anyway, while he was doing that, I was finishing Mech Commander. And
super well-liked real-time strategy game.
Yeah, yeah. That was my first taste of like big game development. Because there was like 20-something people on that. And before that... My teams were like 8,
right.
10.
Which was normal back then.
Yeah, but it was complex. It was the most complex game I had ever made, and I was just overwhelmed. I'd get into the office at 7:30 in the morning and leave like 9 midnight just to keep my head above water.
That's a lot.
And also, I was reading a book on how to use a computer at night, too, but that's another story completely. And a true one, because I didn't know how to use a computer at the time. But anyway, so, and then Jordan, after we shipped Mech Commander, he and his partner, Denny Thorley, sold FASA Interactive
right.
to Microsoft.
And FASA was the umbrella under which all these things you're talking
right.
about were happening
right,
with
right.
Jordan.
Yeah, there was FASA Corporation that did the board games and the RPGs, And then there was FESA Interactive, and we did, you know, the MechWarrior type stuff.
Yeah. So you end up running FASA Studio at Microsoft.
Yeah.
And we get to sort of where I think your name enters the modern gaming lexicon. Not that it wasn't all, but really, like, you know, you reach
along with foul language,
a new level. Yeah. Yeah. So because here comes Shadowrun.
Here it comes.
This is a game that this is an IP that's beloved. Another Jordan Weisman IP.
Oh, absolutely.
Cyberpunk.
Yeah. Cyberpunk meets Magic. It was a real cool mashup.
Which, yeah, and it's a great idea. Everybody loved it, and everybody was wanting a video game of it to come back.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
It does sound like a good idea. So here, what happens is a first-person shooter, Shadowrun, gets announced.
Yeah, that happened.
So what I want to sort of walk me through this, because was it the original idea that it was going to be a first-person shooter if you're going to do a new Shadowrun?
Yeah. We never had the idea of making it into an RPG.
Okay.
We never did.
Was
RPGs were not big at the time. That was not good business at the
time.
That's
true. That was sort of during the valley of role-playing development.
This is in 2000, I want to say 4.
Yeah.
That we started conceiving of the game.
Right. But KOTOR hit. That was huge.
Was that around that time?
Yeah, it was... I think KOTOR shipped in 03, if memory serves correctly.
Game.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite RPG ever.
But also, we were tasked with making an Xbox game.
Yes.
And this was really before Jade Empire, for example. It's like, oh, yeah, all right. You know, I'm pretty sure that I'm right.
Yeah, KOTOR first, then Jade Empire.
Yeah, right, yeah. And so, the idea of an RPG on the Xbox, I don't know, I just wasn't feeling it at the time from a business point of view.
Well, yeah, because I guess Deus Ex hadn't come back yet. Human Revolution hadn't shipped yet.
It was while we were working on Shadowrun that Deus Ex hit. And it's just like, that's a good game.
So did you guys... So this is sort of pre-social media, really.
Thank goodness, yeah.
Nevertheless, there was a, let's call it a vocal response in the community when it was announced as a first-person shooter and not as a role-playing game.
I will say just one thing, though, that if it wasn't for the Shadowrun first-person shooter, I don't believe the Shadowrun Returns would have happened and happened as passionately.
Which we'll get to later. Yeah.
It's just, that's the interesting thing about it. It's just like, it was a sort of a seminal moment for me as a game developer, because that's where, unfortunately, I truly learned respect for your audience. You have to have an audience disrespect you because you've disrespected them to really understand it, and that was perhaps the biggest learning of all.
But right. Which anyway. Yeah. We're on our way. Walk with me here, Mitch. Yeah. Just take a walk.
Oh no,
with
my
me.
Heart is beating like a mother. It's like, holy crap, we're down this rabbit hole. Let's go.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that I would be triggering bad memories
it's
here.
Actually, yeah, it's true, though. You should know this. I forgot to mention this. This is the creation of Shadowrun, the first-person shooter, which some people call Shadowrun 2007 or 2K7, was the single hardest, worst experience and best experience of my life, one of the very best.
Yeah.
It was both, but it was absolutely a terrible, terrifying ride. It was unbelievable.
So I'm here to interview you. Anyone anticipate a negative response to it being a first-person shooter? And I'm talking before it came out.
We'll get to it just being a first-person shooter?
Yeah, just like, shooter? Hey, this sort of cult classic tabletop IP that we love is not coming to video games as an RPG.
Yes. I believe there were some of us that did, but that's not the mindset that we had at the time. The mindset that we had at the time was, how do we make a hit?
Yeah.
That's really what we were after. We were trying to swing for the fences and really deliver on the promise of our studio to really make something big and epic and would make people really take notice and, you know, would sell millions and millions of copies.
It's funny to me that in hindsight, that Shadowrun first-person shooter feels almost vastly ahead of its time.
Yeah,
in the sense that it was It really had no single player campaign.
That's right.
Which was unheard of then, but now is somewhat accepted.
Funny, yeah, the reviews came out, and they're like, it has no single player campaign. This is BS. And then later on, Team Fortress came out. It's like, yeah, it's perfect. It has no single player campaign. It's like, you know.
And then, you know, sort of class-based, multiplayer, abilities, all that stuff that's very normal now.
Yeah.
Even the cross-play.
Yep.
Did you guys volunteer for that, or did the Microsoft overlords go,
no, that was me.
We got this initiative, we need you to do it.
Yeah. What happened there, honestly, is that development was rocky. But that was internal. External, what my bosses were looking for was a big PC game. They wanted to show their commitment to PC.
Right.
But we had been developing it for Xbox, and all of our decision-making was Xbox-related, controller-related.
Sure.
And the controls were just great at the time.
Yeah, they were great.
It was a great design team. They were killer at their jobs, you know, in terms of how to make, you know, something feel right. And so my bosses, you know, met with me. They're like, hey, we'd like you to make this a PC game instead. And...
Oh, instead?
Instead.
Instead. So just forget... We won't even bother with this on Xbox. We want it as a PC game to show that we're serious about PC gaming.
So that was their agenda. My agenda was, no, I'm trying to make a hit game on Xbox. This is... The studio's geared up, and I have everybody, like, revving on, yeah, we're going to make a hit on Xbox. And it's like, we'd like you to make a PC game. But in retrospect, especially after having lunch with Phil Spencer, he told me, wait, how did this go? Because at the time, he wasn't the one delivering the message. It was someone else. And
Ed Freese was...
No, this is after Ed. This is Shane Kim.
That's Shane Kim days, yes.
Yeah. And so the way Shane said it was, you know, we want to show our commitment to PC, and we want to put this out on PC. Phil's point of view on it was, we've got Halo on Xbox. We need something of that caliber and that level on PC, right? Which is a different story.
Sure.
That maybe I could have gotten my head around, but I didn't. And then Robbie Bach, who was the president of...
Yep, head of the whole shebang.
Yeah, entertainment and stuff. He wrote this really great memo around the same time, talking about the future of connected entertainment. And there were no action items in it. There was no, like, call to action. He's just like, this is the future I see. And he was talking about what we're seeing now with mobile and Xbox PC, or console and PC, and the whole connected world. He was writing about this. Yeah, he was totally right. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, he was in here.
Oh, that's right, he was. Yeah, I ran into him a while back at a con. It's like... Didn't you used to work for me? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh, that was you. Anyway, so he wrote this fantastic memo, this visionary memo, that didn't get a lot of traction, I felt, at the time. But I was inspired by it. And I thought, hey, wait a minute. What if I gave, you know, my bosses what they were looking for, a PC game, you know, but we cross-platform, and to show what connectivity is and how Microsoft's leading the way.
Right.
And I wrote my own big memo, you know, and I wanted it to be DirectX 10 at the time, you know, exclusive and so, you know, business.
Yeah.
Which has nothing to do with game development, by the way. It has nothing to do with making a great game. But that's how that came to pass, was connecting the dots. And then I realized, oh, this is a way to really get the game elevated in Microsoft and get lots of marketing dollars behind it. It was all that kind of thing.
Sure.
But it had nothing to do with the fans. It had nothing to do with them or what they wanted or what they expected. It's the single biggest learning of my entire career.
Yeah, I remember when it came out, I worked for a publishing company on an Xbox magazine. We had a PC gaming magazine down the hall. And we did a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Can the gamepad console guys hang in Shadowrun with the mouse and keyboard PC guys? The answer was not at all.
Really?
Not at all.
You know, I've gotten that from a lot of people. But what we did was, I had an internal test team of... It was large, and there were 16 core testers on that game.
Yeah.
And 8 of them were tournament Halo players, and 8 of them were tournament Half-Life players.
Yeah.
And so they would go head to head every day. And we felt it was fair and even, you know. So I don't, even after it came out, because I've heard that before. Yeah. It's like, no, the Xbox guys dominate. It's like, really? Because I saw every single day.
Sure.
These guys,
yeah,
they were shouting at each other. It was great. That was one of the best parts about it, was just playing the game.
Awesome.
We played it like 3 times a day, you know, organized, and never got tired of it.
Was there a thought to trying to put a campaign into game?
I cut the single player campaign.
Because reality, you know, you probably have a certain budget and a certain window, and you gotta make choices.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. We had been in development of a single player campaign for a while. We had about hour long sort of vertical slice of the gameplay, and there was some cool stuff that never got into the multiplayer game.
Interesting.
Like the ability to raise the dead, and so you'd kill the enemy and then you'd raise the dead, and you have this army following behind you.
That's awesome.
Fighting for you, and that was great, but it didn't quite work out for the multiplayer game. But yeah, we had a whole single player campaign. So imagine standing in front of a room full of about 100 game developers saying, yeah, you know, I just cut the single player campaign that you guys have been working on. Like I said, you know,
a lot of learning
on this one.
Yeah.
A lot of learning.
Do you regret that at all? Like, do you wish you'd somehow forged ahead and shipped that game with a campaign?
You know, I have a lot of regrets in my career, but none of them have really anything to do with business decisions or game decisions. All of my regrets have to do with how I treated people at the time, at any given time. It's like any management mistake that I made, people management mistake, that's what keeps me up at night, or when, you know, or when I'm thinking about it and you get a little melancholy. It's about that. It's not about the games themselves. They are simply what they are. The games are sort of like historical documents. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And they're just a product of a time and a place, so no, not much.
Yeah, you were not thrilled with the reviews that Shadowrun got.
I was definitely crispy by the time they came out, and yeah, that was rough. But I was completely on tilt at that time, and so yeah, I'd be interviewed, you know, OneUp.com. I did a podcast there. It was an epic, like, 2-hour where I just was yelling at the interviewers and stuff. Yeah, I didn't do well in that particular time.
Do you sort of look back on that period with remorse, or just like, no, you know, you just, or it just was what
no,
it was?
No, I don't care about that. That doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't managing them, so screw it.
Right.
And I don't care. I mean, I misbehaved, right? And so I had a reputation more as kind of an idiot for a while. Like, somebody who gets mad at the reviews of his game when the game clearly deserves some of the reviews, well, now you're just a petulant child. You know what I mean? So that, when I look back, that's the only sort of regret I have about that. But fuck it. Whoops, screw it. Oh, do we bleep here?
Just say, it's the show's literally called Unfiltered, so say whatever you want.
Oh, it's on
it's
then.
Fine.
All right, great. Yeah.
So, don't worry about it.
That is oddly enough, that doesn't bother me. I was not embarrassed by my own behavior. I was just like, oh, you were just wrong, you know?
I was mentioning it a few minutes ago. Do you ever stop and think, man, if Shadowrun, the shooter, came out now, it'd probably have done, like, way better?
I never think that way.
You don't care? I mean,
no.
Not that you don't care.
But
sorry.
It's not that. That's just not the way I think.
Yeah.
I don't do what ifs or anything. I'm a really in the moment guy. I'm making this game. I have this milestone, and I have this feature I'm trying to shepherd, or something like that, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't do that.
I will. I do imagine you're happy that there was no social media to amplify the things
great.
You were saying.
Yeah. Who knows? I might have been drummed out of the industry. You know. Yeah.
I mean, that sort of, not to that extent, but you know, that's kind of what happened to Adam Orth, also, you know, fellow Microsoft guy. He was in here a couple of years ago before his most recent game came out. But
yeah,
you know, he got kind of the pitchfork and torch mob coming after him.
That's rough. Yeah. That's a rough feeling, you know, to know people are angry with you out there. You don't even know them,
right?
And they're angry with you. That's an interesting feeling. But it was that was far less important to me than the feeling like I was letting down my team. that's it. That's everything to me. The team is everything. And so, yeah, the team went through hell through that. And I lost people and rebuild the team. We actually did, during the middle of that game, we stopped production. In the middle of that game, I hired in a new production team, kept the producer that was on it, and added around him. And we did a post-mortem in the middle of production.
Oh, wow.
And the woman running it was really smart and really brave. And she sat me down in front of the whole studio after she had done like five post-mortems with different parts of the team. And she said, all right, here's what I've found out. And she said, and in front of everyone. Yeah. And she just starts reading down the findings that are all like, you've mismanaged this, you've mismanaged this. And it's just a list. It's like, take your medicine. I'm like, okay. I took my medicine. Then we methodically attempted to fix every single thing on that sheet.
Did you volunteer for that sort of the public, not public, literary public, but, you know, for that to be in front of everyone?
She just did it.
Okay.
She just did it.
Like, it just, she felt that you needed that in front of everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think she did me one of the greatest services. Her name's Dana Hanna, by the way. She did me one of the greatest services of my career by doing that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that?
High degree of accountability. To be more honest and direct with my communication. For a while, I was messaging to people instead of just talking to people.
Yeah.
You know, and I had never done that before. And I don't blame Microsoft for this in any way, but I was assimilating culture that I shouldn't have. You know, I was attempting to shield the team from the greater Microsoft culture.
Right.
Right? It's a studio. You know, and they have to, there has to be an umbrella, what they used to call a shit shield. But that didn't mean I wasn't taking on some characteristics by osmosis.
Yeah.
And I don't blame anybody for that. It's just sort of what happened. And I became the wrong guy for a while.
Hmm. All right, you've endured your personal hell long enough. Let's,
hey, cool.
Let's walk out of, I'm jumping around a little bit. I actually want to go back to a pretty universally beloved project, Mech Assault.
Oh, great.
Which was,
yay.
You know, you were the executive producer on that game.
No, I was the producer on that game.
Okay.
I was an EP on Mech Assault 2.
Okay.
So I was the publishing producer on that. The real talent, the real producer on that was TJ Wagner, who was in our studio and flew out to day one in Chicago and help them ship the game.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But Mech Assault was the original killer app for Xbox Live. You know, Microsoft's got this online service that they stuck an Ethernet port into every single console that they promised would work one day.
Yeah.
Or they promised would do online things one day.
Yeah, I had no idea if that was going to work or not. I really didn't.
And then here it comes,
yeah.
And and it was fantastic.
It was really fun. And it was really fun to work on it. I mean, it was super intense because the Xbox Live was launching, and we need a launch title.
Right.
And it's you. And Ed Freese said to me, Mitch, you have carte blanche.
Oh, like, yes.
So you always on. That was it was awesome to be given carte blanche by Ed Free. It's just like, get out of my way. I'm shipping this game. That I live for. That was really fun. And I love the game. And the idea of the first time we ever went home and put on our headsets.
Yep.
Right. I think the first thing ever said, certainly maybe not on Xbox Live itself, because there were demo things, but the first thing ever said during a test of a real game on Xbox, I said, I'm not wearing pants. And the test team went, that's awesome, thanks. But that was the power at the time. It's like, oh my God, I'm playing a console game at home. It was cool.
Yeah, I mean, the game itself was, you know, it did have a single player campaign as well, which was great.
Yes, it did.
And it's, you know, I don't know whose idea was it to take MechWarrior and sort of just kind of actionify it on a gamepad.
Denny Thorley.
It totally worked.
Yeah, the president of Day One Studios, Denny Thorley, it was his idea. And his idea, the camera was actually top down, more top down.
Yeah.
And then it was actually Ed Freese who said, no, drop
Bring
the
it
camera
back.
Behind the shoulder, kind of in that sort of, you know, Gears of War sort of thing.
Right.
It's like, drop the camera. And that actually changed the game. Ed actually had a major influence on the gameplay of that game. It became much more arcadey.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is.
And then, is that one where, you know, Are you surprised at all by the success of that, or did you sort of know, like, we've really got something here?
Oh, no. I did not know at all. No, I knew it would be fun. You know, I knew it would be fun. And, you know, especially the multiplayer was just, it was really goofy.
Yeah, it was fun.
I really enjoyed it. It wasn't Battletech. It's just like Shadowrun.
No, it was much faster, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it really wasn't steeped in the lore or anything like
right.
that. But it was fun. And no, I had no idea, because I didn't know if Xbox Live would take off at all.
True.
You know, and I knew it was fun, but I didn't think it would actually be a hit or anything like that. And that's great, you know. I'm really happy about that. But no, at the time, it was just like, I have to ship this game, because Ed told me to.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
So there, it wasn't a situation then where one of those things where you have Mechassault 2 in pre-production before the first one even quite finishes up?
No. We went right into that to shipping DLC. Like,
yeah, which was also a new, you know, new endeavor.
Yeah. It's like, wait. And that was huge for me, just as like a, whoa, you can do this.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in an era where if you patched your game, you were a failure. Right, on PC.
Right.
If you patch it, that means you screwed it up and you had to patch. And now the idea of, oh, this thing kind of is alive, and it's still connected, and you can get more stuff for it.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool. It was really inspiring.
And remind me, my memory's failing me on what that DLC was. Was it a mech and some multiplayer maps, or what?
Yeah, I think the first DLC were some multiplayer maps. Oh, okay. Maybe new game modes, too.
Ah, okay.
But a new mech. You know, mechs, because of the complexity of them, you know, the pieces and the animation stuff, we had to sell that DLC. But that was also Ed calling me on the phone saying, Mitch, I want paid DLC. I'm like, excuse me, what? He's like, yeah, like $5. Just $5 yeah. for like a new mech.
Right.
All right. You know, so yeah, that I didn't conceive of that. I just did what I was told with that one.
Just executed the plan.
Yeah. Exactly.
So then Mech Assault 2 does come around. I didn't like it as well, so that's just me. I'm kind of curious why didn't Mech Assault continue? Did the second one just not sell great?
Yeah, exactly that. It didn't turn into the franchise that Microsoft was looking for. That's all. They had at the time there was sort of just a sales bar. You don't hit that sales bar, it's like, okay, that was that.
Yeah.
And I disagreed with that mentality, and I still do to this day. And I told him that at the time, you know, a very respectful conversation. It's like Crimson Skies, for example, deserved a sequel.
The original, or are you talking about High Road to Revenge?
High Road to Revenge,
Xbox.
Right.
Yeah.
High Road to Revenge deserved a sequel. That team deserved a sequel, you know? But at the time, Microsoft decided, and Shane Kim specifically decided, that each studio would focus on just one game. And we were doing Shadowrun and Crimson Skies simultaneously.
Yeah.
And still working on Mech Assault and stuff. It just collapsed it all down. And so High Road to Revenge didn't get the sequel it deserved.
Are you, when you've got both those, are you just riding high because you've got these two hit games?
No.
No?
No, it's never like that. It's always, what's the next milestone?
Yeah.
It's always like that for me personally. No, there's no riding high. There's the joy of shipping. And there's the joy of being at with your team smoking cigars when you ship.
Yeah.
And then it's right back to work.
Hmm.
And that's just that. That's my entire life.
Does it make you feel, I mean, you tell me you're a live in the moment guy, but you know, does it feel good to you when you hear just sort of constant... There's always this sort of constant little voice in the community of people wanting to see Crimson Skies come back.
That's great, but that's not a personal thing. I feel good about that on behalf of the team that did all the hard work. You know, I really, you know, although being, I wrote the original design doc for the original PC game, but somebody else actually made that game. You know, I was on to Mech Assault, Mech Commander 2 at that time. And so Jordan and a guy named John Howard made the PC game. And then the Xbox High Road to Revenge, you know, I was an EP on that, and I was managing the design team, but not actually a designer on it and stuff like that. So I feel less ownership. You know, that team did a great job, and I helped them.
Yeah.
You know, I was carrying ammo for them to fire.
Right.
You know? So when I see, like, it just came back.
You can go home, play it on your Xbox One now.
Yeah, that's badass. That's
cool.
Really cool. But I don't feel a personal sense of satisfaction. I feel pride for the team that they got that opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then during your time at Microsoft, you were also involved in a game. This one, I know you from your Microsoft
era
primarily, and I've bumped into you here and there since. But I did not know you were involved in the South Park Let's Go Tower Defense game.
Yeah, I actually conceived of that one.
Really? Tell me about
Trey.
That. Yeah, really?
Actually, yeah. What happened was I found out that Trey wanted to make a game.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they'd kind of been laying low ever since it sort of had some misfires on the video game side,
right.
Like in the N64 era.
Yeah, yeah. And so I found out that, and, you know, we had some ideas for games, and Trey kept turning them down. So I said to the person who had the relationship with him, get me on the phone with him.
Yeah.
And so I got on the phone with him. He was really cool. I just said, what game do you want us to make out of South Park? And he said, I want sort of a strategy game, but kind of, you know, fun sort of action strategy game.
Right.
And that's all the guidance I got out of him. I'm like, okay. Hey, and then right there on the phone, I said, what if it was a snowball fight? And the kids are in a snowball fight, and they're setting up their snow forts and stuff like that, and it just gets out of control. He's like, yeah, let's make that. And that was it. That's how we made that game.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I just spitballed something at him.
Because that was sort of the beginning of what we're actually very much still enjoying, an era of good South Park video games.
Yeah, definitely. A Stick of Truth and stuff like that. Yeah, and I dig that. Yeah, that's what happens when you get a really great RPG company to make an RPG. What do you know?
Yeah.
They can do that.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
Is game development just... Most gamers just, and not through any fault of our slash their own, we don't understand how difficult a line of work it is.
No, I hear that all the time on Twitter too. You know, people like, you know, there are two sides of it. Why don't you just do this? Why don't you add this button to the game that does this thing? It's like, okay, that's a $50,000 decision, you know, or whatever it is. And then the other side is like, they don't understand us. And so what? You know. I'm serious, so what? So people don't understand how hard game development is, and you probably sound like a complete whiner when you talk about it, and that's why I don't. What's the point?
Yeah.
You know, nobody cares how hard it is. They just care if the game's good.
Yeah, they just pay their $60 and want their cool thing.
Yeah, and the other thing, it's, in my experience, it's just as hard to make a bad game as it is to make a good game. You know, the process of making a bad game or a good game is kind of the same, and it's just as hard.
Let's talk about something that I hope will be a little happier.
I am. Seriously, though, the passion thing is, that's what keeps me going. That's the happiness.
And it's
cool.
Very genuine, yeah.
Yeah, but my palms can stop sweating now, you know, for a little while anyway.
Well, hopefully your palms don't continue sweating at the mention of the name Jordan Wiseman.
No, that one's easy.
You've kind of been comrades in arms for a while now.
Yeah, it's been...
On and off, and right now very on.
7 years.
Yeah.
Before that, you know, there was Microsoft. We were there a dozen years. Although he was only there about, I think, 4 years out of the 12 that I was there. And before that, at Fest Interactive. But we actually met. He doesn't even remember this, but I do. And he wasn't anybody at the time.
Yeah, I was literally going to ask you how you met.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you're a good interview. So I was at Gen Con, game convention for tabletop gaming, that I'd been going to since I was 14. When I was 15, Jordan was running a game at Gen Con. He was 21 and I was 15. And he was running the Last Starfighter board game. And I got into it. And it was awesome. Because even then, and this is before Shadowrun and it was before Battletech.
Yeah.
But he had it going on. You could tell. And here's this 21-year-old kid, and he had the Last Starfighter game. He had this huge table with a black mat that he had handmade on top of a starfield, and it had a grid that he had hand put on it, and he had gone to a garden store and gotten like cool porous rocks, and there were rules. So we were fighting through an asteroid field, which is awesome, and the rocks were huge, and he built a scale. Everything was this big, right? So my starship's this big and stuff, and the rocks every turn would tumble
in an interesting
direction. And so, and it was just this brilliant game. And so I remembered him. But I was just some kid in his game.
That's cool.
That's how we met.
And then, you know, through Microsoft, and then you come 2011, Harebrained Schemes.
Yeah.
You two found it together. So,
yeah.
So how is, you've just got done telling me a bunch of war stories about big corporate life at Microsoft.
Oh, there's war stories for little corporate life, too.
how is independent life compared to big corporate life?
Probably the quote, you know, I would, you know, what is that? You know, serve on your knees or live on your feet or whatever. I don't know how that works, but whatever that is, it's that, you know. So I don't have a lot of those in my back pocket. I have my own things I like to say. But I like calling my own shots. And by my own, I mean with a team of leadership.
Right, just you
team.
And your team and nobody.
Yeah, I dig that.
No
a lot.
Omniscient voice up top.
That's fun, but it's not exactly that. Because I wouldn't mind like working at having a boss again. That doesn't bother me. I don't mind having a boss. What I mind is when it's not about the game, and it's about initiatives, You know, like, here's a strategic initiative, which means we're about to fail. That's what that word, right, that term means. Strategic initiative means, uh-oh, everybody's about to get screwed, and it's not about gameplay. And so all I want is to really create minute-by-minute gameplay experiences. And working at a big company, it's all about other things that aren't that. So that's what I like about the small company and being, quote-unquote, my own boss. And then also, you know, nurturing the talent I want to nurture, as opposed to somebody says, here, take this guy.
Yeah. So you guys made the aptly titled Shadowrun Returns.
We did. We made games before that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, our first game was a bet between Jordan and the then CEO of Bungie that he couldn't make...
Who, Pete?
No, before Pete.
Oh. Who's that? Is that Harold at that
Harold.
Point?
Yeah. Harold Ryan. Yeah. Harold and Jordan made a bet that Jordan couldn't make... a good game in 10 weeks on mobile. And so Jordan made the bet. And he had a three-slide PowerPoint. Like, this is what the game is. And it was basically three images that he could talk to. That was basically it. There may have been a line of text on each one. And that was a game called Crimson Steam Pirates. And Harold's like, all right, I'll take your bet, and I'll put up this much money. And Jordan said, okay, I'll put up this much. And then I was consulting with Bungie at the time on Destiny before it was announced.
Interesting.
And Pete was the one, because Pete is an old friend of Jordan's. And Pete said, hey, why don't you go produce this with Jordan? Because they were trying to get into mobile, and I was working on strategy for that. He says, go ship this.
Bungie Aerospace.
Right, exactly. And so Crimson Steam Pirates was the first Bungie Aerospace game. And so he says, Jordan needs a producer. 10 weeks, go make a game. Like, okay. And so Pete is the one who put the two of us together. But I was actually being paid by Bungie, you know, and Jordan was doing this bet. And that's how we became actual partners, because I didn't report to him. And it turns out that worked great. We just had a great, you know, sort of yin and yang, nearly adversarial relationship, where he would come in every day and I'd say, I cut two features. It's good, because I just created two more. And that was our relationship for, actually, it turned out 12 weeks.
So what, you were consulting, you just said you were consulting on Destiny in the early days.
Yeah.
Would they sort of bounce ideas off you?
It wasn't
like?
About that. It was about more of a business strategy about, you know, multiple screens and stuff like that. And if there were companion apps or, and we were just exploring stuff. You know, together. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I had nothing to do with Destiny at all.
So, Shadowrun Returns is you're an in the moment guy. You've just told me.
True story.
But do you look at the Shadowrun scar from 2007 before you sit down to make Shadowrun Returns with the team?
Oh, hell yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it was actually in our Kickstarter video was, you know, we were trying to figure out, because we did this Kickstarter video, and the big question that we had internally, and at the time there were only about 12 people in the studio, maybe less, and, like, what do we do about Mitch? Because we're going to make this game, but what if people find out Mitch is making it?
Right.
They're going to hate it, right? What do we do? And... one of our engineers said, you know, we should just throw fruit at him in the video. And so that's why I held up a sign that said, sorry, and everybody just threw stuff at me.
Yeah. That is the way to go. You just embrace it and just...
Get
and
in
then,
front of it. Yeah.
That's
and
the way
I was sincere about the sorry, but actually members of the Shadowrun 2K7 team were pissed at me for apologizing for their work, right?
You could see that, yeah.
Of course you could see that. They sweat,
of course.
You know, blood, sweat, and tears and all that stuff that went in. You know, you've got a sense of what it was like. But I wasn't sorry about the game we made. I was sorry that we didn't create a real Shadowrun experience. You know, that I was sorry for. And that's
well,
the thing.
You're
going to regret
that. You did make a real Shadowrun experience. Just not a role-playing game, right? Not the thing that
certain people... No, I disagree
with
that either. No,
okay, well, it's your game. I want to make sure, because otherwise I knew that quote was going to just be taken somewhere.
No, that was not a real Shadowrun experience at all.
Why not?
Because it was frosting. There was no cake. Shadowrun is one of the best game settings you know, that I know of. It's just so ripe for brilliant stories, social commentary, all sorts of things. And here we had elves and dwarves and trolls and guns and cyber and stuff. It was bullshit.
Would the campaign have been a little cake instead of just some frosting?
Oh, yeah. The campaign, I don't think I've ever told anybody.
Yeah, I want to hear about this.
The story of the campaign did not take place, and this was kind of wrong, too. I was completely messed up with this, with all of my decision-making on this. But the idea was that the game took place at the time of the Awakening. The idea that when magic returned to the world, people started turning into trolls and orcs and stuff like that and getting magical powers. And that's where we set the single-player story, is right there. So I wanted to call it like Shadowrun Awakening or something like that, and to set up a series of titles to get us to what Shadowrun ultimately became.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was wrong at the time to throw people into such a complex setting. You know what I mean? It was like, there's cyberpunk.
There's a lot to take in. Yeah.
There is, but that was a huge learning also. It's like I underestimated the audience, and that's stupid. You know, they're way smarter than that. You can throw a lot of stuff at the audience, you know. So, yeah, so many learnings on so many levels.
Shadowrun Returns was excellent. People loved it.
Oh, man, thank you.
Yeah.
That was really hard work. I loved it. That's one of the best experiences in my whole career. That was the most exciting thing.
And what made it the best?
Well, first of all, Kickstarter was... the hell is Kickstarter? I remember we were making a mobile game, and our lead engineer at the time was showing me Kickstarter because he was backing stuff. And then he looked at me, he's like, no. I'm like, we're going to Kickstart a game. He's like, no, don't do that. And I don't remember why, but he was dead wrong, which is awesome. And and then I pitched it to Jordan. He was like, oh, I don't think so. Because it would be making a game in a fishbowl. I had an idea of doing a documentary alongside it, and so we
have you spoken to Tim Schafer down the street?
No. What happened was and then Tim did it.
Yeah,
right.
And it was awesome.
And it was
not only the game, but the documentary as a gamer.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
For me, backing that was regardless, the game happened to be fantastic.
Yeah,
but
right.
That was worth the price of the admission just for the documentary.
It's the honesty.
It is,
right. That's the thing, right? It's always being genuine. That's the biggest lesson of all, is being genuine. Anyway, I pitched that whole thing to Jordan. He's like, yeah, that sounds like hell. You know? I'm like, you sure? He's like, yeah. And then Tim did it. He's like, okay, maybe we should do that. And so we were only like maybe the third or fourth video game Kickstarter at the time.
Yeah, right when it was blowing up.
Yeah, yeah. Brian Fargo was doing, you know, his In Exile stuff.
Yep.
He had launched, 2 weeks before we did? Something like that? I don't remember.
That was Wasteland, right?
Yeah, Wasteland 2. Yeah. And he was just making a path. He was just laying down blades of grass in front, you know, because we had no idea how to do this. When we did the Shadowrun Returns Kickstarter, the day the Kickstarter launched, one of my friends said, so you ready with your stretch goals? I said, what are stretch goals? And then it funded in 28 hours, and we're like, uh-oh. And then we were just making it up from there. And it was just this improvisational ride.
Yeah.
That was it. And that never ended until the game shipped, you know. And we shipped a year later, like almost to the day, I think. And we were the first $1 million-plus Kickstarter to actually ship. So that was part of the excitement. It's like, we're shipping. We actually are going to prove that you can do this and stuff. So that was cool. It was just an exciting time.
And got to be happy that people are happy with the game, and it turned out very well.
Oh, yeah. You know, like I was saying at the time, you know, I had red in my ledger, so to speak, and to be able to erase some of that with Shadowrun Returns and prove, no, I know how to make a Shadowrun game. It's just, I didn't. No, I can't.
And you've since made another one.
Two more. Yeah, Shadowrun Dragonfall.
Right?
PC and mobile.
Right.
So Shadowrun Returns was on PC and mobile. Shadowrun Dragonfall, which I love. That was some of the very best work that I had personally ever done as a writer. You know, we brought in a guy named Andrew McIntosh, who completely brought our writing game up to the next level. And then I was following his lead, which was awesome. And that was just a magical experience, too. And then we did Shadowrun Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all three were really well received by the fans. And that that was cool.
More of those coming? Going to keep the Shadowrun train rolling?
You never know. You never know. Right now, we're living in the moment. We're shipping battle tech someday. You know?
I did want to mention Necropolis real quick, though, because that's actually the... That's what I saw. I saw you for the first time in years because of Necropolis.
That's right.
I had no idea you were involved with it, and we were able to catch up for a few minutes. But, that game, it seemed really fun. I sat down with it for like an hour or two last year. I very much enjoyed it. It was sort of the Dark Souls-y type concept.
Right.
But with
Dark
definitely
Souls lightish.
Yeah, with its own spin on it. Respectfully, as I'm researching the interview, it didn't review super well.
Actually, one of the reviews said Necropolis couldn't entertain the dead, was one of the reviews.
But that writer thought they were clever.
Maybe I've decided to stop judging reviewers now. I learned that lesson.
I don't know, I'm one of them, so...
Yeah.
When I looked at it, I was like, it came out in October. Do you regret? Like, it's tough to get anybody to look at a new IP that time of year.
Well, we actually shipped PC first, and then shipped the console versions in October. But, that wasn't a strategic decision to ship it then. It was like, that's when the game's done.
Right.
When you have a small studio, it's like, how much money do I have? How much can I afford? All right, this game is coming out now because I can't afford to put more time and money into it. It's just that.
Yeah, and you can't sit on it because you need the revenue.
Oh, yeah.
I presume.
And while you're sitting on it, you have to pay all these people. So no, it doesn't work out that way. Yeah. We had to ship the game, and we shipped it much earlier than we should have, or much earlier than we wanted to.
Right.
That
brings us to BattleTech.
Does it? Yeah, it does.
Well, it brings this interview to BattleTech.
No, that's right. It does. Yeah, but also chronologically, it leads us to BattleTech. And another Kickstarter, too. We kickstarted BattleTech.
Is it fair to call it a spiritual successor to Mech Commander? Is that a fair assessment?
In some ways,
Just, in the sense that they're both BattleTech-based real-time strategy games.
Well, no, that's it. Exactly. Mech Commander was real-time, but our BattleTech game is turn-based.
Right, turn-based.
And so... In some ways, it's a spiritual successor, but there are two major things that are very, very different about it. This game is even more steeped in the game setting, and to really give players a sense of what BattleTech, the game setting, really is. If you only know it from MechWarrior, and then which MechWarrior you know it from, for example, it really colors your perception of the BattleTech universe. And so here we actually are able to tell the story of how BattleTech came to be. It's a 35-year-old game setting with like 200 novels.
Yeah, going back to that. I remember growing up in the sort of the MechWarrior 2 era.
Yeah,
which
that's
is
right.
Mid-90s, I guess, something like that. Or, my buddy Robert had the tabletop book with all the schematic drawings of each of the mechs and their stats and all that stuff.
Yeah, we actually had the guy who did those schematics work on BattleTech.
That's cool.
Yeah, to design new vehicles for us and stuff.
So what's, excluding the current BattleTech game, over the years, what's your favorite video game incarnation of BattleTech or MechWarrior?
Of MechWarrior? My favorite, probably MechWarrior Mercenaries. And that's one of the reasons why our BattleTech game is also a mercenary game. There's just something, there's a sense of agency to being a mercenary. So you get to interact with all these noble houses without choosing one, without being a member of one, and you get to, be a loner, so to speak, and travel around and do what you want to do. But you get to see the BattleTech universe and interact with it without having to choose, House Liao, House Kurita, or whatever it is.
Right.
So that's a big thing. Oh, I'm sorry. The other thing I was going to say earlier, besides the lore of BattleTech and being able to do that, the other thing that this game does, because it's turn-based, we can expose more interesting BattleTech mechanics that are inspired by the board game. So we really wanted the game to feel like we felt when we were playing the board game 30-something years ago, and the mechanics aren't true to the board game. They can't really be in a video game, but we really wanted to feel like it felt. And so I think we're successful with that. So heat management and stuff like that. You don't want your mech to fall down, lots of stuff like that.
It's I wonder if Jordan had ever conceived of how well MechWarrior and BattleTech would translate to the video. Like, it's such a it makes for such good
did.
Video games.
Yeah, of course he did. That's who he is. He's a visionary. No, he really is. He's Willy Wonka to me, right? And he's going to go into his garage and tinker around and come out and go, hey, what about this? And you go, oh my God, yeah, let's do that. So, I mean, even when he was making the board game, he was conceiving of those BattleTech cockpits where people could play, play against each other. That was the vision that he had always been working towards, and he got to create that. And there were like 30 of those BattleTech centers around the world and stuff.
So, with the new BattleTech game, it's a PC.
Yeah.
Is it under those sort of same licensing restrictions that you were mentioning earlier?
Yeah.
So it cannot come to console for the time being.
It cannot for the time being.
Is that frustrating at all for you?
No,
because
I don't
you could
care
reach
at all.
A larger audience, you don't care?
No. This is the hand you're dealt. Let's just play the cards as best we possibly can.
Yeah.
Nah, I don't think about that kind of stuff much. I wonder why. I'm not a very thoughtful game developer, I guess. I just want to make the damn game.
Well, I guess I'm sure if there's pluses and minuses to kind of having that, just putting the blinders on and not worrying about all that other stuff that you can't control necessarily.
Well, that's the thing, right? You accept the things you can't control the things you can, and know the damn difference.
Yeah.
That's it. And that's why, I'm not in the hospital today. Whoops.
I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, well, during Necropolis, I actually was in the hospital for a couple of days.
That's not good.
That's what the team said. And my wife.
Well, I hope you're okay now. You seem good.
Happy to be alive.
Good. So you've worked in the industry a long, long time. You've taken
right,
me on that,
with
quite
that.
A journey.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's a
no,
compliment.
It's a journey.
It's a compliment.
Okay.
Relax, Mitch.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. No, it's like, you survived this long. Congratulations.
So you have an interesting perspective, having worked, through all the way up through, a long time at Microsoft and now, on your own with the team at Harebrain. So this is like, the dumb college kind of entrance question, but from your perspective, where do you see the game industry in the next 5 years? Because we've seen a lot of change in the last five.
We sure have.
And it's certainly
insane.
A hell of a lot different than, when you started, and certainly during your time at Microsoft, it changed a lot.
Yeah, the evolution's insane. I can't believe I've gone through all of this.
Yeah.
I didn't know the world would go through all of this. So, it's like I don't put things in boxes anymore. What the hell? Where's my cover art? So that's weird. Where do I see it going? For me, it has nothing to do with hardware. I don't give a flying anything about VR. AR is really interesting. Jordan loves AR. He's done it before.
I do find it interesting that you don't care about VR when certainly BattleTech and MechWarrior would seem to lend themselves incredibly well.
I don't want to put on the
flash in the pan. You don't think it's going anywhere?
I'm not going to make a prediction. I predicted this. I predicted the launch would be terrible. And that there's no killer app and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And who wants to put this thing on for hours? You just don't. I don't.
Yeah.
I don't want to put it on for more than 10 minutes or so. I thought it was going to break my nose. So, no, I'm not into that. I don't care about console versus PC versus mobile. I love making mobile games. I love making PC games. I love making Xbox games. I don't care. The medium, so to speak.
You like AR, stuff. Though.
I think it's cool. I want to make one. I want to make one, but that's not where the industry is going. That's just like, that would be cool.
Have you played with HoloLens?
No, and I want to.
It's
I know
pretty,
people that worked on.
Yeah, it's
too.
Pretty neat. I mean, the version I tried, the viewing area was literally like a mail slot. But in that mail slot, it was awesome.
Yeah. So one day maybe there was actually some AR in a game we made called Golem Arcana. That was really neat because it was a game board thing with playing pieces connected to mobile. It was really neat. And you could hold up your phone and actually see the 3D models and stuff. That was cool. So I'm interested in that. But as an industry, we're going through something fascinating right now. It's fascinating and torturous because the egalitarian nature of it now, how anybody can get really, really powerful tools for free or cheap, And anybody who wants to make a game can do it.
Sure.
And they can put it on these app stores or on Steam. So anybody can make a game, which I think is a beautiful, beautiful thing. I think that's intensely cool. And I used to teach game development at a school in Seattle. And, you know, I'm a big fan of that. Anybody can create. And there's a flip side to that. Anybody can create. And so the app stores, and it's just filled to the brim.
Yeah, it's a filtered, you know, the filtering it is difficult.
Oh, there's no end caps, really. I mean, there is. It's like what's right in front of you, you know, and then how much, you know, can I get a decent game recommendation or something? So trying to break out of the noise of that, I think, what was the stat I heard? 40% of the games on Steam came out last year. 40%.
Yeah, I believe that.
Came out last year. That's insane. And so the pressure on people like us who are trying, you know, who are aspirational, you know, BattleTech's the biggest
bubble to the top of that.
Yeah. And there are absolutely fantastic killer games out there, really well reviewed games that are that have ass sales because you're just being flooded by these things and then everybody's waiting for the sale. Right? And so these super talented, you know, career game developers, they're just going nowhere. Or even not career game developers, but really pro, doing pro work,
yeah.
It doesn't matter. So it's such a double-edged sword for me. You know, and I'm sad about it as a developer, and I'm happy about it because I want people to create. I love that idea.
The BattleTech, having the BattleTech IP in your pocket probably helps. Helps you get noticed.
Of course it helps. Absolutely it helps. That's why one of the reasons we're making, besides loving BattleTech and loving Shadowrun, you know, I saw Kickstarter as a megaphone. Here's how a little, like, 8-12-person little indie studio can make a lot of noise real fast by doing this Kickstarter thing. And that's one of the reasons why we did Kickstarter, that and to get the money, because we didn't have any.
So give me the... Close us out, Mitch.
All right.
Give me the... For people that maybe haven't kept up on BattleTech and what it is, and the give me the Cliff's Notes version. Get everybody interested.
All right, my PR people would be very happy.
Yes.
About this. So
you're not here for your health, after all. You're here to promote a game.
No, I'm not here for my health. Now. I
clearly, I've driven you to.
Yeah, no, you're fine. And I, you know, I haven't had a drink all day. The what time is it though? The so BattleTech.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
That's right. BattleTech is a modern turn-based tactical combat game. And so it's all about, you have this lance, what we call a lance of four mechs, like a squad, and you take them out on missions as a mercenary.
Yeah.
And you travel all over what we call the periphery. It's this giant star chart.
31st century, right?
Yeah. It takes place in 3025.
Yeah.
Good point. You know, humans actually learn, not faster than light travel, but jump travel. They could actually just jump far, you know, light years away, and eventually colonize, etc. And then this thing called the Star League formed, which is kind of like Camelot. And then, you know, well, Camelot fell, and so did this. And so it's a universe in decline with all of these warring successor states vying for the throne and using giant robots to try and take it. So in our game, you're traveling around taking mercenary jobs from some of these, you know, noble houses and the other petty dictators and things like that, taking jobs. And then there's also, so that's an open-ended campaign that you can just keep playing.
Nice.
You know, and then on top of that, you interact with the story of one woman trying to retake her throne that's been usurped by her uncle. And you choose whether to help her or not. You don't have to interact with the story. You can keep doing this. And ultimately, she'll fail. And the civil war that she's trying to mount will fail. But if you help her, well, first of all, it's very lucrative. She pays very, very well. if you help her, you can help her retake her throne. So there's this whole story. And, you know, it's the same writing team that wrote the Shadowrun game. So we take story and character very seriously. You know, it's not an RPG or anything. There's no branching plots. There's not even multiple endings or anything like that. But we try and tell a good story, and one that's really true to the BattleTech setting that gets the themes of BattleTech out there and stuff like that.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Skirmish mode, multiplayer, coming next year.
It's just 2018, not being any more specific than that for now.
I don't feel like it. I'm so tired of it.
You don't want to be pinned down. It's fine.
Well, yeah, I don't like even to pin myself down. I, you know, I would like to take forever to make a game. That sounds great, you know, but you got to put it out. You don't learn until you put out a game anyway.
All right, well, we'll be keeping an eye out for BattleTech.
Please.
Mitch Gittleman, one of the co-founders and the boss man, co-boss man, co-boss, over at Harebrained Schemes, right, working on BattleTech.
Yeah.
For much more on the best, brightest, and sharpest, most interesting minds in the games industry, stay tuned to IGN Unfiltered each and every month.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.